This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 5 months after democratic elections, the next step in Iraq's political process is at a stalemate. The provisional government has until August 15th to hammer out a proposed constitution, but the drafting committee has yet to meet because there's no agreement on the number of delegates from different constituencies. Shias and Kurds were appointed in proportion to the number of delegates elected in January, but most Sunni Arabs boycotted the election. Now some Sunni groups want to be included in the drafting process, but finding a number agreeable to all has proved difficult. As talks continue, so does the violence. 4 suicide car bombings and other insurgent attacks today killed 10 people. Over the weekend, Iraqi police discovered 20 corpses buried in a field. With the resistance based in Sunni areas, many attacks on government forces, mostly Shias and Kurds, take on sectarian overtones. Similarly, government raids and counterattacks are usually targeted on Sunni communities. To many, it appears that political reconciliation is racing with the prospect of civil war. Later in the program, the unofficial audio tour of the Museum of Modern Art and your letters. But first, sectarian divisions and the Constitution in Iraq. If you have questions about this process, how it's going, and where it's headed, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin in Baghdad with Laith Kuba, the spokesperson for Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari. He's with us by phone. And Mr. Kuba, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
There have been reports that some leaders of Sunni insurgents or some in contact with Sunni insurgents are using backdoor channels to get in touch with the government and see if they could negotiate their way on this committee. What can you tell us about this process?
Well, this happened after the landscape elections. I think there is a deep and genuine conviction among Sunni community who initially boycotted the elections. Now they realize that was a mistake. They're moving into the political process fully. That leaves insurgents exposed without a cover, and in fact, it makes those who want to be part of the political process potential targets. That change is going to consolidate the political process. Some of the groups believe the whole argument about resisting the occupation is over because there is an elected government. It leaves few insurgents who just believe in terrorism or basically using violence for no clear end still out there free. But those groups who want to be part of the political process are coming, and I think the government is encouraging them.
Is the government encouraging all political groups, even those who may have been involved in attacks on Americans or on the government?
Well, the government certainly draws a clear line. Those who attacked people en masse and terrorism, those who killed innocent Iraqis, civilians or in government, those basically who are currently using violence, there is no room for them. Those who were involved in the past in some form of quote-unquote resistance, and they basically say it's a new phase and they want to be part of the process, I think there is room for them. Hopefully none of them has committed crimes. But broadly speaking, the government is encouraging those who want to join the political process to be part of it.
And obviously Sunni participation in this process is vital if the Constitution and the subsequent elections and the next government are all to have credibility.
I think so. There is realization across the board. In fact, the government has already allocated seats for Sunni ministers, although they were not elected. The Prime Minister and the President both are endorsing and encouraging the Parliament to reach out and include more Sunnis. They cannot force the Parliament to do it, but they are certainly putting pressure on them to do so.
Have you had any indications, any assurances from some of these Sunni groups that you're talking about that they would publicly stop supporting the insurgency if they were brought into the political process?
In fact, many of them, I think, have done so, not only through channels, but some of them quietly are just changing positions and without admitting guilt or previous convictions. They want to be part of the political process. Others are openly saying we want to be come out in the open and say we were not terrorists. We believed in resisting the occupation. None of them has come out to the open to say so. I think they fear some legal consequences and they might seek amnesty. But this is premature to talk about it in such details.
And then there is the question of how many Sunnis would be appointed to the drafting committee. They have, at least publicly, the number that we hear is 25. The Kurds, who have as many number of people in the population, at least we're led to believe, have 15.
Real terms, numbers don't matter, because whatever draft is put there, if it is rejected by three provinces, and the Sunnis certainly have three provinces, then it will not gain to pass. What is important is to have a text that would win the agreement, consensus, I would say. But symbolically, it's important whether you recognize or don't recognize the size of the community by numbers. I think it's usual politics about numbers, but the essence of it, all parties know it's in their self-interest to reach such an agreement.
The other question, if the number of if the issue of numbers can then be fudged or if it's not important, the other question is time.
This worries me because we spent too much time about just setting it up. I think we need more time to argue maybe two or three articles in the Constitution, something to do with the structure of government, federalism. Those are hot issues, the distribution of national resources. There is a lot of negotiations that need to take place there, and some catch up from the Sunnis in terms of negotiations. It does worry me a little bit, but the government is determined to deliver the draft Constitution in time.
Now, if it wants a six-month extension, it would have to ask for it, as I understand it, by August 1st.
That is correct, but as I said, there is every reason to believe that both the Assembly and the government believe we're going to give it a shot. If it's not going to pass, we'll know by October, and then we just have to start all over again. There is no point in wasting time and then starting all over again. So the attitude is to have it on time.
We're speaking with Laith Kuba, the spokesman for Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Ali is calling from Minneapolis.
Hi, good afternoon, Neil Conan.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to make a point and ask you also a direct question to the spokesman for the Prime Minister. I'm a Sunni Muslim, and we all know, Americans know, the whole world knows, that the most civilized people in terms of educational, scientific leadership in Iraq are the Sunnis, as well as also they are the people who led that country for many, many years through many difficult times. If Americans are the country that are pushing the Sunnis on the sideline, but even if they succeed in doing so, and the Shiites and the Kurds support them, it's also logic to say that there will never be an stable democratic Iraq ever again without the Sunnis' major contribution, and not only the Sunnis, but the Islamic parts of the Iraq, which are also representing the Sunni, which Americans also contend that they are the minority. Sunnis are not minority in Iraq, and everybody knows that. And I'd like to ask you also, the Prime Minister's spokesman, why is it that there is a media war against Sunnis, and at the same time they want the Sunnis' contribution? At the same time they are fighting a war against Sunnis. I want somebody to also explain to me that point.
Well, Laith Kuba, did you hear the question?
Sure, if I may reply to it. Of course, I assure you, all what the things that you've attributed to the Sunnis about their skills and value to the country is noted, and there is no problem there. I can tell you there is one problem. This is the first time they're entering into negotiations. The Kurds, for example, have been in the political game for a long time. They know what they want. They know how to advocate, how to lobby. I think with the Sunnis, it's just the skills are not there, and their attitude is reacting against the situation rather than trying to be proactive and propose or push an agenda, other than, of course, that of resisting the occupation. The second point is that the government itself has every reason to reach out and include the Sunnis. That has been demonstrated in the number of ministries. The deputy prime minister position was given to Sunnis, although they did not participate in the elections. And everybody realized that was a mistake then. So there is every reason to reach out and include them. But there is a problem out there. There are radical groups that are using violence. Unfortunately, they found home in some Sunni areas. It doesn't mean at all this is with the endorsement of the Sunnis or with the encouragement of the Sunnis. I go often in press briefings to say this got nothing to do with Sunnis because they've also been victims of these radical groups. In fact, they've been more of victims recently because they've decided to be part of the political process. So I assure your listener that there is no victimization of Sunnis, but there is a difficult condition they are going through, and it's in the national interest to help them out of it, bring them to the negotiating table, help them improve their negotiating skills, and agree a constitution with the rest of the country.
Ali, thanks very much for the phone call.
Neil, can I ask one follow-up question quick?
If it could be very quick.
Very, very quick. Also, I think why can't the Iraqi government declare a ceasefire against Sunnis? And then also look at that point and say, okay, now there will be no war with the joint American Shiite forces against Sunni areas, and then maybe wait what the reaction from the Sunnis. Can that be possible?
Could we get a quick response, Laith Kuba?
Sure. Let me give you a quick response. Number one, there is no war against Sunnis. There is war against groups that are putting car bombs in public places, schools, markets, mosques, etc. Number two, a lot of the campaign that is taking place against those insurgents are carried out by Sunni tribes. The defense minister is Sunni himself. I think in the country, maybe living in the States, you don't have the feel of what's going on in the country. People really feel those who are committing these crimes are enemies of Iraq and its people. Sunnis and Shias are together on this. Nobody welcomes car bombers in their streets and cities. And it's unfortunate some of these military raids are taking place in Sunni areas. Care has been taken to minimize damage. But, of course, it does happen, and it's regrettable.
Ali, thank you for the call. Laith Kuba, thank you very much for your time this evening. We appreciate it. Laith Kuba, the spokesman for Iraqi Prime Minister Jafar al-Jafari. We'll be back after a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Iraq and the prospect of creating democracy across political and sectarian lines. What are your concerns and questions about the apparent race underway between the constitutional process in Baghdad and violence that may be building toward a civil war? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Michael Rubin joins us here in Studio 3A. He was a political advisor to the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, goes back to Iraq frequently, was there most recently in April, now a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael Rubin, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
What's your view of this stalemate on the drafting committee?
I think the stalemate is a lot more, there's a lot more going on there than meets the eye. I had the opportunity to sit and chat with Sunni Arabs, with Shia, with Kurds, both inside the National Assembly and outside it. People are actively discussing the Constitution. The main power brokers, the Massoud Barzanis on the Kurdish side and Jalal Talabanis, the Hakims and Jafaris and Chalabis on the Shia side, prominent members of the Dulaimi tribe and the Jabordi tribe and so forth among the Arab Sunnis are hashing out these issues, and basically they boil down to two issues. One is, what exactly is federalism? And the second one is, what exactly is the role of religion in the state?
Federalism, of course, is an issue dear to the hearts of the Kurds, who have lived largely autonomously since the war in 1991 in their own regions. This is an issue that, of course, depends on how big Kurdistan is and whether it includes the city of Kirkuk and access to oil, and whether Kurdish federalism could then block somehow the other groups in the country.
I'd agree generally with you, but it goes a little bit beyond that. When we talk about Kirkuk, we're talking about the borders of federalism. But what a lot of the argument is about the powers of federalism, whether federalism and autonomy are the same thing. Who controls the borders? The Kurdish Peshmerga, as their militia is called, or the Iraqi army? And who pays for that militia? But also the issue of federalism and the issue of the role of religion in the state come into play with each other. For example, is one of the solutions to the religious debates in Iraq federalism, allowing three provinces in the south of the country, for example, Basra, Amara, Najaf, to ban alcohol? Mm-hmm. And so this is all being negotiated behind the scenes.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation, and let's go to Doug. Doug's calling from Lake Tahoe in California.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm calling because certainly I can understand the desire of people to kill Americans as an occupying force, although I don't like it, of course. But I don't understand the factions and what they're trying to achieve by killing their own countrymen. What is it that they want? Why is it that they're doing what they're doing? And why is it they can't resolve those kinds of differences peacefully?
You're talking about the Sunni insurgents, largely?
I'm talking about the people in Iraq as a people, as a group, as the different factions in general.
Okay. It actually goes into the psychology of terrorism. Most of the victims of the car bombings and the terrorism are actually Arab Sunnis and policemen. On one hand, they don't want the policemen to be working with the state. They don't want this state to progress. On the other hand, as Laith Kuba was saying before, many of the Sunnis are coming to join the political process, and the insurgents are basically rejectionist or nihilist. They haven't really enunciated what they stand for. They basically just enunciate what they oppose, and that frustrates increasing numbers of Iraqis who are their chief victims.
Does that help, Doug?
Well, it helps, but I still don't understand why people can't come to the table and bargain in ways that aren't killing little kids and so forth. But maybe that's just a symptom of humanity's problem. I don't know.
Maybe it is, Doug. I don't know. Well, one point that he does raise, though, is the Sunni Arabs under the regime of Saddam Hussein and before that were in control in Iraq. They were a minority in the population, but they ran things for the most part, and now they will not be.
That's absolutely true. But again, this goes back into the issue of federalism and the issue more broadly of the role of the center of the bureaucrats in Baghdad versus the people in the periphery, in Anbar, in Tikrit, in other predominantly Sunni areas. And these are debates we had early on in our history. But it's important not to just associate Sunni Arabs with members of Saddam's former regime. I get emails from Sunni Arab city councilmen, for example, who were victims of Saddam Hussein's regime. And likewise, there were many Kurds and many Shia who were complicit with Saddam Hussein.
Let's get another caller on. And this is Zainab, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Yes, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is all these years, and here in this country, in the media and the politicians, and throughout the world, it seems like everything is biased towards the Arabs, and especially now, you know, their interest and their well-being. I'm sorry, I'm nervous.
Yeah, it's okay.
Their interest and their well-being is much more important than the rest of the country.
When you speak of the Arabs, who do you mean?
Well, I mean, these people, these groups are called Sunnis, or because not all the Sunnis are, you know, against the occupation or against the war or the not all Sunnis were supportive of Saddam.
And of course, the Kurds in northern Iraq, most of them are Sunnis, of course.
That's right. And after all this has happened, and the interest of the Arabs, this minority, seems to be more important than the rest of the country. I mean, I have lost 60 of my relatives to chemical weapons. Hundreds of acres of land were taken from us and given to the Arabs. And after all of this, still these minorities' interest is more important than the rest of us, so the rest of us can have a life. And it's very frustrating.
You're Kurdish, I take it?
Yes.
Okay.
Zainab makes an excellent point, and it's a point that many Iraqi politicians and civil society, journalists, and so forth, have been dealing with. Iraqi civil society right now is thriving. The Kurds are actually leading the way in that because they've had an extra 10 years of experience. Now, if I could just step back, it's important that Jalal Talabani became the first, not only Iraq's president, but he's also Kurdish. And it shows the integration of Kurds into the Iraqi state at the highest level. Hushyar Zebari, who's from the rival Kurdistan Democratic Party, is now foreign minister and so forth. But the thing which gave me the most hope when I was talking to Iraqis, Turkmen, Sunnis, Shia, Kurds, and so forth, Assyrians, was when they stepped back and said, gain some perspective, we have arguments over federalism, we have arguments over the role of religion in the Constitution, but let's look at what we agree on. We agree on freedom of speech. We agree on freedom of religious practice. We agree on the right to use whatever language you want to use, including Kurdish. And we agree on the right to political participation and organization. These are things that not only did Iraq not have in the past, but many of the neighboring states still don't have.
Yes, and I'm really happy about this. I mean, it's been a progress that's happened over the past few years. It's like, you know, it's a time machine or something that's, you know, happened, and I'm very grateful for all, you know, the progress has been made, but I just feel like these small groups are getting funding from somewhere to, slow down this process, and, I'm not sure. I feel like this is going to go on even after, you know, another 20 years, all these this type of activities will go on for a long time.
Well, when you talked about outside funding coming in, one of the issues which hasn't been reported a great deal in the media, but which actually gave me a lot of hope, is the role of the Iraqi judiciary. When I first entered Iraq after the war in July 2003, I was cynical. I thought all these guys were just appointees of Saddam who basically put politics above the law. But among the ethnic Kurdish judges, the Shia, the Sunni judges, they all tend to be technocrats who are for the first time applying law and basically telling candidates and telling policemen and telling others and other judges they can't operate illegally. It does give some hope about the rule of law in society, which fundamentally goes into issues of property restitution and other things which may be of concern to the Kurdish community.
Yes.
Sign up. Thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Frank, and Frank's with us from the road somewhere in New York.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
Okay, listen, I'm just basically listening. I'm just going to keep it simple. I mean, these people are trying to come across, you know, trying to raise a democratic society. You know, I'm assuming based on the American model of democracy, but when our democracy is based on separation of church and state, how do you get that, achieve that kind of democracy when religion is so ingrained into their society?
That's the other big.
How do you achieve a fairness without religious bias?
Michael?
That's actually what they're arguing about right now. In their interim constitution called the Transitional Administrative Law, they achieved the balance by saying that Islam would be a source of legislation rather than the source of legislation, and they had a counter clause which said that no law can be passed which isn't in conformity with Islam. The problem is when you go into the minutiae of who decides what Islam is. I attended a conference in April of 150 Iraqi women in Jordan, and it was interesting. There was a delegation of fiercely religious women from Najaf, and there was a delegation of other women from Baghdad. And the women from Baghdad and Najaf got into an argument, and the root of it was, if you argue for Islamic law, then what sort of the Quran, what verse of the Islamic holy book do you base a speeding ticket on? And so they're debating about practicalities, and it's something which with time I think will answer your concerns.
Frank, thanks very much for the phone call. Drive carefully.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go back to Baghdad now, and joining us on the phone is Salih Mutlak. He's a spokesman for the National Dialogue Council. That's one of the Sunni groups involved in talks with the Shia government leaders, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation this evening. Hello, Mr. Mutlak.
Yes, I'm with you.
Ah, good, good. Very nice of you to talk with us this evening. Can you tell us, what are your concerns about the drafting committee that's been set up to write the new constitution?
Can you say that again, please? I'm not hearing you very well.
Yes, I was asking you, we have heard that there are concerns about the drafting committee that has been set up to write the new constitution. What are your concerns about this?
Well, we've been invited by the National Assembly to meet with them and discuss how are we going to be represented in the Constitution Committee. What I mean by we, it means those who did not participate in the election. And there were two meetings were set with the committee which was established by the National Assembly. There were seven people, and we discussed.
And it looks as if we have lost our line to Baghdad. We'll try to reestablish and see if we can get back in touch with Salih Mutlak, spokesman for the National Dialogue Council, which is, as he was just describing to us, one of the Sunni groups that's involved in talks with Shia government leaders. Again, we'll try to get back in touch with him and continue our conversation on Iraq and its constitution. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In the meantime, let's get another caller on the line. And this is Leo. Leo's with us from Palo Alto.
Yes, good morning. Your guest just alluded a little while ago to the fact that there's more that's going on beneath the surface with regard to the delays in the Constitution. And my question is, if I were part of the insurgents or groups that are against this, one of my tactics would be to just sit there and try to delay this process as much as possible in order to get the U.S. deeper in this and beat us basically at our own game.
Delay on the insurgent side, Michael Rubin?
The insurgents, I don't think, have anything to either gain or lose from a delay. If there's popular dissatisfaction with what's going on inside Iraq, that's important. But there's also a nationalist component to this, which the Iraqi government is using. There's commercials, for example, showing Hammurabi from ancient Babylon or Samaria carving in cuneiform the Constitution, and underneath they give slogans such as, in Iraq we had the first Constitution, and we're going to have the newest one now. The insurgents don't want this process to succeed, that's true, but the Iraqis themselves are increasingly taking pride in what they are trying to accomplish.
So basically you don't see any sort of filibustering going on over there with regards to this?
I see there's filibustering inside the normal political process, but I think the insurgents are outside of the filibustering process. Their goal isn't to delay the process, it's to completely disrupt the process. And that's something that Sunni Arabs, Shia, Kurds, Turkmen, what have you, are dead set against not allowing to happen. I really do think the January 30th elections were the turning point, and what you have now is a real political process and debate going on, which is healthy.
Thank you very much, then.
Thanks for the call, Leo. And let's talk with Fadiki. Fadiki's with us from Boston.
Yes, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I heard your guess and, you know, the optimism that he's expressing, but, you know, I'm not seeing any relevancy in terms of what the, you know, I'm not there, but in terms of the situation there, I remember that the statement was made that the elections will break the back. I don't call it an insurgency. I call it a guerrilla war. And essentially what it is with a guerrilla war, you know, what it is that militarily, you know, you pick the battleground and you try to win the hearts and the minds of the people. And so since the elections, you have the Iraqi people seeing, first of all, that the services, in fact, are not increasing. More and more of them are dying. And then when I hear the state, and first of all, I think that this whole Constitution piece, I think it's irrelevant in terms of what's going on the ground. I don't think it's going to change anything. And that, in fact, there is a civil war going on right now as we speak because of the fact that I believe both the Sunnis and the Shiites have death squads out there because, as you just recently saw, they found 21 people that were Sunnis that were dead. So I believe that there's a civil war going on.
I'm not sure that most recent group has been identified as yet, but you're right. Other groups have been identified as either Sunni or Shia, and the possibility of death squads has to be addressed, Michael.
Exactly. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that for ordinary Iraqis, as the temperature starts to swelter, as the electricity is nowhere near what it should be, people are upset with their daily life, and that tends to be the ordinary person's daily concern. That doesn't mean that they don't have opinions on the Constitution, but it sort of parallels, but with more extremes, what often happens with the debate inside the Beltway in Washington versus ordinary folks outside of Washington who may be more interested in what their local factory is doing or what their local employer is doing and how that's going to infect them and their kids. A lot of that goes on inside of Iraq right now. We're not getting a lot of bang for our buck, that's for sure.
Fadiki, thanks very much for the call. Michael Rubin, thank you for your time today. Michael Rubin is
a
former political advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority and now visits Iraq frequently. He's also a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington and was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, a conversation with an Iraqi-American who returned to his country about a year ago to take up a new life, what life today is like in Iraq. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Just about a year ago, on the day the United States handed over power to the Iraqi interim government, we spoke with a young Iraqi-American who just graduated from the University of California at Berkeley. He was 22 years old and decided after graduation to go back to live in Iraq, where he has extended family. A month after arriving, he married an Iraqi woman. A few months after that, he began studies to become an imam, following in the footsteps of his father and several of his brothers. Today, we check back in with Syed Hossein Kazwini to see how life has changed since he arrived in the southern Iraqi city of Karbala a year ago. Hossein, very good of you to speak with us. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
When we spoke with you last June, it was blistering hot. The electricity was unpredictable. How are things in Karbala today?
Neil, they're pretty much about the same, I guess. Not too many changes.
That must be difficult to abide after a while.
Yes, it is. Of course, last time we spoke, it was in June, and we're in June right now. So the weather is still about the same. It's very hot during the day here.
Describe to us what daily life is like in Karbala. I mean, we read of a country that's at war, car bombs going off. Do people go to work? Do children go to school? What's security like?
Neil, Karbala is an exceptional province or city in Iraq. As for the security issue, it's actually a very good city. It's a very safe city. People go to work. Students go to school. You see women, children, people of all ages outside in the day. It's relatively very well. The security issue is wonderful here in Karbala.
Do people have jobs? As you know, unemployment is one of the biggest recruiters for any insurgency. Are people in Karbala working?
People are working, but unemployment, I would say, is about 50%. As for other cities in Iraq, they're probably even more. But because Karbala has a high rate of tourism, there's a lot of tourists coming in for performing the religious pilgrimage. People are working. But unfortunately, in other cities, people are not that fortunate.
Do people go out in the evening, go to restaurants?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a few good restaurants, and people do go out. There's a good nightlife here in Karbala.
And what about during the day? Big internet cafes, computer connections, satellite telephones, that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. When we spoke last time, not a lot of technology advancement was here in Karbala. Now there's a lot of internet cafes. People are owning cell phones. About a year ago, about almost no one owned cell phones. Now people have own cell phones. They have computers in their house. They have satellite dishes. This is something new. This is one of the things that occurred during this year.
Satellite dishes. So what do people watch on television?
Mainly news, but not Al Jazeera. Definitely not Al Jazeera, because it doesn't stand with the Iraqi people. They want to watch news that stands with them, that provides true news.
What's your favorite program?
I watch all sorts of satellite channels, especially news, because I like to get, you know, different perspectives on what's going on. Most of these news channels, they do have some sort of bias.
I'm told that there's a program at 9 o'clock that's very influential in Iraq.
Yes, absolutely. It's on the Iraqi satellite channel sponsored by the Iraqi government called Al Araqiya. They used to have a show at around 9 or 10 p.m. Where they'd put on terrorists captured, and they'd interview these terrorists. And it's amazing to see that most of these terrorists, they'll tell you they've accepted $200 at most, if not $100, to perform terrorist acts killing Iraqi soldiers or U.S. troops for merely $200.
So people get to put a face to the insurgency.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You see what sort of people they are.
Karbala, a Shiite city, of course, one of the centers of Shiite learning everywhere in the world. I wonder, though, if you could just tell us a little bit. It must be awfully different being a student there than it was at UC Berkeley.
Of course, of course. UC Berkeley was definitely a different sort of experience from Karbala. Karbala is a mainly religious, even though I majored in religious studies at Berkeley, yet I was exposed to all sorts of religions, all sorts of professors. I studied mainly under Jewish professors in Berkeley. Here, my main professors are strict Islamists, but we get a wide variety of Islamic studies, from philosophy to jurisprudence to law to Arabic grammar.
It must be tough, though, going into the family business. Your brothers, your father, your grandfather, all were imams.
Absolutely. It's not tough at all. I love what I do, and I love what I study.
We have a caller on the line for you. This is Ali. Ali's calling from Lansing, Michigan.
Yes.
Go ahead, Ali. You're on the air.
I just wanted to send my my greetings to my good brother, Hussein. My name is Ali Dabaja, and we've known each other for a while. And I actually wanted to ask the question, now that he's gotten a taste of Karbala, a taste of Iraq, does he feel that he may that he's going to continue his studies or come back here to the States, or does he feel that the situation there is safe enough to continue studying and to perhaps continue with his life? Mm-hmm. And Brother Hussein, I just wanted to say what's up, man.
It's very nice to hear your voice, Brother Ali.
Same here.
I've known Ali for a while, and I'm very glad to hear his voice. I plan on living here in Karbala for a while. I'm actually in the process of building a house, and that means I'm here to settle down. I feel that I have a long road ahead of me in two ways. First of all, in studying, I feel I have a lot to study. And second of all, I feel that I have a lot to offer to the Iraqi people and to my own country, a country that has been suppressed for the past 35 years. I think we're doing a good job. Especially my father, he's doing a wonderful job in preaching to the people freedom, freedom of expression, democracy, freedom of religion, freedom of press and speech. I think we have a lot to offer. However, I probably will see you either during the summers or during the winter.
maybe at times when the air conditioning is better here than it is there. Ali,
absolutely, absolutely.
Thanks very much for the call, Ali. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We also have another caller. This is Najat. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. And Najat with us from San Francisco.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was just wondering what the feeling of the Iraqis are about the enormous number of deaths that have, the Iraqi deaths that have occurred during this war.
To be honest, the Iraqi people have become accustomed to death. Death has been something normal to them. Starting Saddam had took the Iraqi people into many wars: the war with Iran, the war with Kuwait, the war with the U.S. twice. Death has become something very normal to them. However, as people still cannot adjust to death. Especially in the year 1991, when Saddam unleashed a brutal war against his own people, something unheard of throughout history, when a president wages war against his own people, hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. It's very sad. People have gone through major depression. And after this war, after this current war, people are trying to gain back their lives after this major depression. And for some people, it's become very difficult.
Najat, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
And Syed Hossein Kazwini, thank you for staying up to speak with us this evening.
It's been my pleasure, Neil.
And good luck with your studies.
Thank you very much.
Syed Hossein Kazwini joined us from Karbala.